Blog Talk Radio.
Ideas flow, and we examine one of the smartest ideas that many of us have ever come across, a way to activate some of our thinking, to share the spots of private's notions, that those questions that are not necessarily reconcilable, but need to be asked. The questions that have to do with a mature mind, examining notions of character, trying to improve himself as we plunge through the ether and are spinning away at our usual 56,000 kilometers. It's great. Welcome. On this, the Equinox, what a special day. It's past, of course. You know, that happened about 12:32 a.m. around here. It's that day when the plane of the Earth's equator passes through the center of the sun. In other words, the sun is directly over the equator. So we have the same. This happens twice a year, as you can imagine. Around here, 20th of March and the 23rd of September. So we enjoy this period of the phenomena and peculiarities of this little spinning top in the universe. The days are approximately equal duration. You and I can claim that we're somewhat imbalanced today. But it's not exactly equal, like everything. It's always little qualifiers. And this is really to do with the physics of the situation. Angular size of the sun and the atmospheric refractions. Sometimes we use the word equinox and just to use the mean. To mean a day that the durations of light and darkness are equal. And of course, when we're fooling around with the notions of, when we're playing with the elbows on the table, playing with profound ideas, leaning in on it, the oldest meaning of the word refers to a day of equal duration. But this was something that's been celebrated for millennia. Yeah, we tens of thousands head off to the pilgrimage at Stonehenge. Some reconstituted notions of Druidic faith, although you know the Romans killed off the Druids, kind of remarkably sad in a way, because the curious minds who would like to have just listened to what the accumulated knowledge was about can't really do that. So we ask our historians to mine that information and try and pull out threads of what Druidic religion was about. But in the short strokes, Druid priests had the verbal history. They were the knowledge. So everything, all the knowledge was passed on. And so you actually had this living scientist, this living library, this living history. It would be easy to see where a culture would begin to revere such a person. So we have that as an interesting, curious linkage with our past. We think, estimate that ancient cultures built hundreds, if not thousands, of huge megalithic structures and stone circles and temples, secret inner rooms that aligned with the sun at its major annual stages, like the solstices and equinox, right across Europe and Britain, Egypt, yes, North and South America, many other parts of the world. Most today see it as a form of sun or agricultural worship and pagan celebration. Pagan, a note to self, pagan being an idea that was marketed very, very widely by the earliest Christians back in the day when they were clamoring for market share and had to create some distance. And we've all seen and heard how some people will create a straw man argument to make their point at the expense of somebody else. Let's talk about the basic philosophical fallacious arguments. It's just so I'll put that out there. I'll make a little note to myself. The sun, the source of all the light, and do we say it's source of all life, is central to a cosmic spirituality. It's both ancient and timeless, and as ever present as always. Principles have formed the basis of many of the world's religions, and unbeknownst to many of us. So what do? We move on. Here I'm in that bit of a conundrum that if we are true to our roots, we are an audacious group, we Freemasons. We don't own audacity, but we are audacious. I've been troubled for many years, I think since maybe 2011, something like that, maybe. When I had a conversation with a fellow who was promoting an international educational conference, scholastic conference, and over drinks into the evening, was very, very pleasant company, wonderful, incredible host. I let it be known that I thought that the best part, the future of Freemasonry, was potentially greater than anything we've accomplished in the past. Anything. Gentlemen, dreamers got a dream. But I began to think that in the day, that's exactly how this whole matter came to be. Dreamers had to dream. Whether it was the scientists who were curious enough to think about the explanations given to them for natural phenomena, and as they puzzled through it, were seeing that things didn't really add up. You know, the sun didn't really circle the Earth. So the Earth really then wasn't the center of the universe. And all of the planets and stars around us didn't really center on Earth. This was a period of enormous superstition. We don't sanitize or wash the conscience or intellect of the human race with science. There's still vestiges of pockets of people that believe the superstition. So that's just like we are linked genetically and biologically with our root, whatever that root may be in your mind, it is of the past. Our thoughts and some of these notions remain today. The castigation of women is something that's so curious and odd. That composite of Helen of Troy. A real woman? Well, I suppose if you like the movies, you know, you're fond of the Trojans, yeah, and the Spartans, yeah, of course. Who better to blame for the war of all wars? Yeah. Now we have to wonder whether Helen is a composite, developed much as we've developed other composite phenomena in our mind to answer questions. But oh my goodness, we, those Freemason deists, became a challenge to Freemasonry, the challenge of Freemasonry. It's a theological and philosophical position that combines the rejection of revelation and authority as a source of religious knowledge with the conclusion that reason and observation of the natural world are sufficient to determine the existence of a single creator of the universe. Oh dear. We are not relying on the canons and orthodoxy of religion. I think there are many closet deists running around. You're listening to one of them. Yes, I like believing in the fantasies. I like I like Santa Claus, Easter Bunny. That's the way I was brought up. But the supernatural interpretation of events. I like Santa Claus. I like the Easter Bunny. I like the notion of that God grants favors, but I think the Creator is the source. I don't think He's there at my beck and call to do me favors. That anything that happens because of work, diligence, and good fortune is just that. And I think that's just perfectly acceptable. That's a good life. Not that some supernatural spirit has done something. Although, I tell you, I've been in situations where I think, but for the grace of God, I do think that way sometimes. Hey, come join me tonight. This is a good one. You know we're coming up to Easter, don't you? How do I get to Easter without thinking about a little shout out to our brethren in Newfoundland that have had who celebrate St. Patrick's Day properly with a day off, a day of holiday. So we've just passed that, on the 17th. And to all of our brethren who have Celtic roots, we all were Irish once. And as Billy Connolly would point out, you can imagine all the our brethren, their ancients, sitting around in Ireland, and somebody came over and said, we've found this great place. We should all go there and explore it. It rains a bit more than Ireland, and it's colder, and it's nastier. It's a hell of a lot nastier. There's not many people around to bother you. And it's gray all. It's a horrible place. But we should all go over there. Geez, at least the land would be cheap. is that the meaning of the cheapness in our Scottish? blood bloodlines. Many of us are owe a great deal historically to the people of Ireland. So to all of you, a belated Happy St. Patrick's Day, and may the spirit continue with you through the rest of the year. I'm pretty sure we'll manage that. That said, we're wrapping our heads around Easter, aren't we? It's coming up incredibly soon. Just next week. The oddity is that this is the highest. This is in within the Christian faith. This is the high holiday. Although marketing seemed to focus more on Christmas, and it celebrates the belief of the Jesus Christ's resurrection, came back to life. Now that we would think as that the spirit came back to life, the spirit that lingers after the body has gone. The spirit continues. It's March equinox coincides with Easter Sunday, and the holidays are related to it. And these holidays do not fall on a fixed date, at least in the Gregorian or Julian calendars. And Julian is still used in many Orthodox Christian churches. So the dates of many Christian holidays depend on the Easter date, like Palm Sunday and Good Friday and Easter Sunday, Ascension Day and the Pentecost. But according to the Bible, Jesus' death and resurrection occurred around the world, around the time of the Jewish Passover, which was celebrated on the first full moon following the vernal equinox. So think equinox, full moon. Significance? Oh yeah. This led to Christians celebrating Easter on different dates. And at the end of the second century, some churches celebrated Easter on the day of the Passover, while others celebrated it on the following Sunday. Well, of course, what better than to sort this out by having a committee meeting? And yes, the committee meetings were no more strident in that day than they are today, because unlike the scientific community, which is not immune to being very turf-natured, in 325, the Council of Nicaea established that Easter would be held on the first Sunday after the first full moon occurring on or after the vernal equinox. First Sunday after the first full moon after the equinox, or on it, if that's what happened. And from that point forward, Easter date depended on the ecclesiastical approximation of March 21st. So Easter is delayed by 1 week if the full moon is on Sunday, which decreases, little qualifiers there, which decreases the chances of it falling on the same day as the Jewish Passover. So this council's ruling is contrary to the Quadratissimans, a group of Christians who celebrated Easter on the day of the full moon, 14 days into the month. So there you have a little bit. First, the Sunday fell on the first Sunday after the first full moon. So equinox, full moon, first Sunday after, or the first on or after the vernal equinox. There you have it. That's as much time as I want. And what else is perplexing us here in Canada is this. I read that a lot of boys are having heart attacks on the day after the daylight savings time is adjusted. A lot of guys are going. And there's been a correlation being drawn between the shift of a clock, that phase, and mortality. So this makes me sit up and pay attention a bit. I do need some proof or evidence. And people dying at a higher rate, that gets my attention. Do I understand fully what the connection would be between daylight hours and death. Well, if I want to play silly bugger, I can act like it's all ridiculous. If I want to take it a bit more seriously, I would plunge into the work being done on circadian clocks, that process that each you and I have. So I'll leave that with you. You decide whether we need a daylight savings time. And man, have we got a smoking topic today, masonry pillar and post. Kick back a little bit, go and get another glass of freshy. We'll come back and listen to a little Helen Merrill and Stan Getz that will just knock your socks off. Just incredible. You back? Too much? Yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it? Mm. Today I've been thinking about the future, moving on. You know, I think that we're a bit disorganized when it comes to the promotion of innovation and idea. In fact, we are running around as if, you know, or we've been captured and function as the Kirk. If we all don't like the idea, well, it can't possibly move forward. My goodness. Where would we be if that was the prevalent outcome of our existence? Of course we have to have martyrs. Of course we martyr our artists and our scientists. Of course we do. Time reveals the merit. After the Greeks sentenced Plato to death, about 7 years later, they realized the error of their way and started to put statues up to honor the great thinker. Too late for Plato. Significant for the likes of me and you. But does it erase or admonish the utter futility of the demagogues, of the people in the market, the argument, the court of public opinion, that impulsive, irascible group, you know, so quick to judge before there's fact, to act without any sense of justice. Justice isn't about the exercise of law. We can't tolerate an existence based on the adherence to law because it's inhumane. So we have judges, we have jury, we have habeas corpus. We call all of that rights. We examine the mitigating circumstance, no matter how heinous the crime. We examine the mitigating circumstance. And we're not perfect, but we're better than an autocratic, totalitarian regime. We are. Some commentary today. Let me share this with you, if you don't mind. It's Masonry, Pillar and Post. Born innocent. How we progress, whether we advance, whether we are the person we think we are. At times, a life well lived is as clear as it can be murky. We like to flatter ourselves that if left uncluttered by the remnants of other lives, other thoughts, external events beyond our control, there would be a pure, real me. As if we be the caricature of a man, living in a fishbowl, propelled through the ether until our light extinguishes itself. That light is given to us for a reason. Without light, our other senses become sensitive to the world in which we live. Without light, our other senses become sensitive to the world in which we live. Seeing is not the only sense we have. But light is such a unique gift among other gifts. The exception. Just as masonry is that exception, it's free and accepted, we give something to the apprentice. We refer to that gift as the exception. It requires the act of accepting it. And we ask a lot of "do you" questions of our entered apprentices. And they agree because they're accepting something that's novel, inspiring, essential, fundamental. I'm not convinced exploring as nature intended is at all clear without some sense of what is out there to see. You have to have a sense that we wouldn't be going anywhere unless we had a sense of this notion of discovery. There's something else out there, that curiosity. If all one knows are shadows on the back of his cave, then who am I to disagree with him? If he says those shadows on the back of the cave are reality, and those forms, they conjure these ideas in my mind, who am I to challenge him? Just as long as he exists in the back of the cave, it means he's not looking over the edge of the cave to see what's out there. Who am I to tell him that he's wrong? Based on that reality, who am I? Now, if I leave the cave every day and come back with a sense of completion or industry, all I'm doing is wondering or hoping that the spark of curiosity is in him too, in all of us. Who am I to disagree? I am surprise. I am sensation. I am curiosity. I am challenge. I am Freemasonry taking off the wraps to look into the imponderable. We are born with information in our minds. We don't exactly know the source, but we know it is there. We have some theories. And as simple as it might be, I can replace darkness with light. Regardless if I can see it all. Pillar and post. Little article some of you may have noticed in the December edition of The Square. Some of you might get that. That's British publication. It comes out from Lewis Masonic, and it's an independent magazine for Freemasons. So, yes, the order and the evolution of Freemasonry is it requires that we embrace some of our roots. We look back at these groups, esoteric, and we question their approach to Freemasonry. But do we dare to question their right to challenge, to sensationalized, to be sophomoric? Well, if we do, then we probably need to take some responsibility and address the bigger question. How did we let this happen? How? Neglect? It doesn't matter. Foolishness? No, I doubt that. Distracted? It would be disingenuous to say those things. It would be, I think, more valid to consider that we've been a product of into a postmodernist philosophical framework now. And it tells us a great deal if we ask the question. So what is happening around us, and what does it mean to you? What is being said? What is being studied? So I have to get back to a fellow who sent me a really wonderful, wonderful article about morality plays, and just really beautifully written. But if he's listening in, here's part of what I want to talk to you about. I don't it's a standalone, but when I speak with you, you're always linking really interesting ideas with purpose. Yet the article is sort of out there. It's like data without being put into context. It doesn't really have any meaning. Oh, we have great data. We have great facts. Now, those at the back of the room that are bringing, oh, you can lie with statistics. That's what you get from mathematics. You can lie with it. That's it. That's all you got. Oh, dear. How does it feel to be that right? And where's that attitude getting you? Any better off? I really doubt it. No, in fact, you're not better off. It's just a conceited notion. But in this work by, I'll call him the Cameron. This is lovely. It's a very, very nice piece of work. He talks about the things that, from the beginning. It's really, he wasn't talking about the Big Bang. He's writing about the evolution. What happened after the Big Bang? How many years? You know, the ideas, you've heard of Masonic effects. We look at the source of the ideas, but we can't trace them back to somebody's hip pocket. So we look at periods. Here we're getting into the period of enlightenment again. So this fellow is writing about what the future will hold. And he's quite right to do that. Freemasonry isn't of the past, or is it, in your mind? So we're studying, we're now printing using the first printing press. That's it. We are performing our work using the ancient pigments. We are using, we're not using Euclidean geometry because that wasn't there at the first, or fractal geometry. Oh my goodness. We aren't operating in a universe with proof of the Higgs boson. And you know that's how? Amazing that we can sort of shop through the events and the thoughts and select those that substantiate our own meager beliefs. So challenge them. Here's a Freemason. Isn't somebody whispering in your ear, you're a Freemason? Start to search for the things that you don't even know exist. Be curious. That's what we are and who we are. We've become so timid about trying to reenact a period in time. So I love the reenactors. Go down to Niagara and like, I really do. And the muskets and the camps and the men and women and how they're living and how they're talking. Oh, there's limits, of course. You know, somebody might have a wristwatch on and somebody might have a pager in their back pocket and somebody might be wearing modern glasses. And if you're cut or injured, well, we're going to use antibiotics and modern medicine. We're not going to, if you break your leg, we're not going to do is saw it off, and then, or if you're in a bad way, we're not going to bleed you. And think about it. The future has more potential than our past. Our past is incredible. It's not the way, the lens that we've been looking at is really colonial. Where the hell did that come from, eh? We have to live as a colony of the a period in time long past. Nice try. How's that working for you? Well, it's not the gravitas of Freemasonry. That's politics. You decide. Do you gain a great deal of merit by clinging? There are boys out there that want you to list every achievement. every Masonic achievement they've ever done, because that's what gives them substance. That personality is so weak that it needs to be shored up by ensuring that those around that come near are aware of the rank. We failed to make a Mason. We failed to pass on. The exception has not been put in place. So do you subscribe to that notion that the future of Freemasonry holds more potential than our past? And can you do that without feeling that it's, in a way, dishonoring our history? History is what it is, but the way we think about it changes. As our Canadian historian Margaret McMillan tells us, history is often manipulated for a malevolent purpose. But when we can look at our history unvarnished with truth, then we're being honest. That's, I think, what's been hard, is that we've known for a long, long time, but it's been difficult for us to admit, to accept that honesty, because, oh my goodness, what does it say about us? It says we're imperfect. It says we have problems. It says we make mistakes. But if that's all that you're saying and all that you're thinking, and you're claiming that's the sum total, you would be wrong. Very, very wrong. We step up. We can acknowledge and admit responsibility. And we can learn from our mistakes. We embrace, whether we know it or not, the scientific model. That experiment is just that. It's a try to see if we can find an answer. So all of the weak-minded out there that think that if we try something, it has to get the result the first time, well, don't be ridiculous. Go and replace, put your apron in the cupboard and get out tarot cards, if that's your thinking. No. Not even tarot. Tarot has a deeper point. Roll some dice. Let that be your guide, if that's your kind of thinking. You have to be right all the time in order to move ahead. We're audacious. We try where all the other people in the room are braying at us to give up. We're too small. We don't know what we're doing. We're fools. We're mean. They'll do things to get under our skin. They'll know how to hurt us. They'll do what they can to throw us off our purpose. Don't do anything because we're a superstitious lot. We have to be guided by our political structure, our legal structure, or the piety of religion. And if you're stepping outside those parameters, oh my goodness, you're a bad person. Come on. Those things are what they are. They're precious to people. Don't trade them, and don't trade on our conscience using those things, feeble excuses. Those things are important. But did you notice that we're curious? Do you notice? You grow older. Have you ever, one day you may have this experience too, where I began to understand that feeling of dying. No, I didn't see from the other side, you know. But that feeling, what it's like. I think. I'll let you know when I get there. But that comes from maturity and age. And I could say that could happen if I were a 12-year-old, a little boy lying in the cancer clinic. And everybody around had a certain level of urgency to them. or that I was likely to die today and would want to say my goodbyes properly and tell the people around me how much I cared about them and how much they mean to me. Maybe that's a maturity that I don't understand anymore, but I know that exists. The future, we have to, I think, admit that we're quite capable, that we have incredible tools at our fingertips. And we're producing incredible minds with incredible ideas. And we will never let go of our past. No, we will never let go of the myths, because that's so powerful in a person's life. We will get it right. We will eventually find that singular theory. We haven't got it yet. We haven't found the singularity in our philosophy. No, but we will. Because we'll be dragged into that, kicking and screaming, whether we like it or not. Oh, we can't have that. Let's get the Kirk active. But I don't laugh completely at the workings of the Kirk, because there's a lot of good that came out. There was that community, the feeling of belonging and purpose, and that's part of my own personal history, isn't it? A long time ago, the Covenanters. That covenant between the people and God rather than the people and the king or some wannabe English king. Four lodges founded the Premier Grand Lodge in 1717, but by 1725 they had over 60. In 1730, 100. And by 1740, over 200. But by 1750, about a quarter of the London lodges have been expelled or erased from the register. Our friend Brother Cameron makes really excellent points in this article. It's really a very comfortable read. Then, in the 1880s, the average age of a lodge before it died was only 15 years. 15 years. Lodges come and go. They cut lodges serve a purpose. And then what are we? We want to, we want to be Dr. Frankenstein and keep the resurrect the dead. You and me, really? They come and they go. I looked at a pine tree yesterday that was about 65 years old. Huge, huge, beautiful old tree. But, the trees have a lifespan, just like I do and you do. So what am I going to do? Ignore that? Try and gerrymander? Nah. It is what it is. I'll plant another sapling. I'll nurture that along. Maybe this one will be an oak, just because. Here we are, 25 years ago, we had 91,000 members in 653 lodges. Now, 37,000 in 540 lodges. Did we oversell? Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't see this as a decline. I see this as an evolution. Not a decline when my tree has lived its life and is starting to fade. That energy will go back into the land and be recycled, and all the little microbes will feed off of it, and life goes on. And life goes on for you and I. Here's a little bit of something just to relax with, and before we wrap up, this is by Sabone Cutmere. Fragile. Mm-hmm. Firm grip on that cup or mug or glass. Sip that wine. So if Freemasonry has created an illusion, it needs to be dispelled in here. Have you been convinced that the best of Freemasonry is in the past? And that the workings of Freemasonry is to attempt to reenact the past? Is that your belief? I think it is, I want to replace that. It is absolutely important, it's vital that we understand our myths. much more central than we do today. Those myths are the energy source, that source, that connection of enlightenment, of understanding the journey, that thing that is common to all significant religions and faiths around the world, religions, is the journey going from somewhere to somewhere. So free yourself, free your mind, not to unsettle and destabilize our order, no, but to examine and continuously re-examine, to continuously learn, to become aware. Oh, if you step into that light, if you're doing it properly, you will know, because you will be criticized. This is where that old adage is whispered in your ear. You really can't please everybody. So use your judgment, but use it wisely. This isn't license to be a fool. If you're sounding like a fool or you don't know what to say, shh. Don't talk. Listen. Listen. Here, this is Henry David Thoreau, Walden and all that stuff. 1849, he said this: it takes two to speak the truth. Two to speak the truth. One to speak and another to listen. You see why the word was lost? We have people that can speak the word, but it takes two. The truth takes two. So the word is lost until there is a listener. Sorry, did I reveal something that was too obvious? I apologize. I apologize deeply. The loss, my goodness. Oh, it was lost because it was hundreds of years ago. Oh, dear. This, I'm sorry, we just have to recognize that masonry has another gear. It does. And it's really remarkably good. There's another gear. Step it up. Yeah, there are lost boys. They come through. We don't give them the exception. We don't give them the knowledge. So they leave, as well they should. Well, we can hound them. We can make phone calls. Oh, don't. Stop your phone committee. Oh. Why don't you just send me a package of brick? Send me a brick and put on it in lieu of the phone committee so I can unwrap the brick and just whack myself in the head a few times. And then I'll smile politely and say, thank you for your call. But at least when I hang up the phone from you, I can just keep whacking myself in the head with that brick. And if you do it enough, I can build a wall. And then I can just keep running into it. I'm never going to progress if that happens. Why, that must be on me, silly boy that I am. Yes, you're doing all of that for all the right reasons, aren't you? Send me the brick. Make that phone call. Hound me. That's what inspires. Yeah. Berate. Yeah, that worked so well when the teachers were doing that when I was 10 years old. That's right. Just criticize and humiliate and ostracize. Oh, yeah, that's... I'm all excited now. Get lost. Get bent. Bugger that. Was there escape from the catalog virtues and vices of Dante's afterlife? Oh, I'm talking about all this stuff, and then I realized there's some minds out there that were brilliant. Dante, ooh. So, if you are wearing your big boy pants, go sit down and do a little study. when this show is over. Punch it, Dante. And study. And don't be all rammy and like you're going to absorb that and want to gulp that down and not swallow. No. That takes time. You're really good with an instrument. Did you learn that in a gulp? You're a very good golfer at times. Did you learn that all at one day? You know the concentration it takes. You ever been fishing for trout? You know that touch. You know the silence. You know you can spook them on in trout streams to just jump all over it. They hear that. But you know that feeling when you just feel that first little tug. What do? You go hysterical over it. Of course, I was taught how to trout fish by Cyril and George, my uncle. So they just told me how it was done, and I had to practice it. Same with masonry. So what door do you want to open? What door? But it's not like you're closing other doors. Was there escape from the virtues and vices of Dante's Inferno, the afterlife? Could there be stories without a moral of human adventure and misadventure? The horrors of the plague provided Boccaccio with the incentive and the opportunity, but for the writer, there was no easy refuge from stereotypes of classic lore and medieval legends, with the themes of love and battle and cowardice and deception and courage. It was only a natural catastrophe that provided Giovanni Boccaccio with the frame for a human comedy in the modern spirit. Boccaccio's early life followed the fortunes of his father. He was born in Florence in 1313, an illegitimate son. He seems still to have been received amicably into his father's household. His stepmother, a relative of Dante's Beatrice, may have been the reliable source for his life of Dante. After a good education in Latin and accounting, at 14 he was sent by his father to the Bardi firm's branch office in Naples to learn the banking business. 6 unhappy years there as an apprentice banker were followed by another 6 years learning canon law at the university. When the kings of Naples needed a full line of credit to finance their defense of the papal cause, the young banker was welcomed at court. There, lusty young lords and cavaliers attended, the bravest and most honorable ladies, shining in glittering gold and adorned with their precious and most rare jewels. These Neapolitan delights stayed with him all the rest of his life, drawing him back to the scenes of his youth. One glittering lady in particular, known under the pseudonym of Fiammetta, would play a leading role in Boccaccio's life and work. At their first meeting, the shining eyes of the fair lady, all sparkling, looked into my eyes with a piercing light, which, passing through my eyes, struck my heart so deeply with the beauty of that fair lady that it resumed its earlier trembling, which still endures. Boccaccio never married, but he did father 5 children by unidentified mistresses. When his father's firm went bankrupt about 1340, Boccaccio returned to Florence, where he would remain a Neapolitan in an exile. "Of my being in Florence against my will, I shall tell you nothing," he wrote back to his companions in Naples, "for it would have to be set forth not in ink, but in tears." He signed himself Fortune's Enemy. Boccaccio's early works were a product of Naples' fertile literary life. When he returned to Tuscany at the age of 27, he had already written poetry and prose on conventional themes of myth and chivalry. In Terza Rima, he recounted a contest between Diana and Venus, and the pursuit by young lovers. Il Filostrato, the story of Troilus and Cressida, was a long epic of the love of two friends for the same woman, who would provide a basis for Chaucer's poem and Shakespeare's play. And from Thucydides, set in Athens in the time of Prince Theseus, Chaucer fashioned his Knight's Tale. In Florence, without the patronage of his father or the diversions of a brilliant court, Boccaccio found it hard to feel at home. After a trip to Ravenna, seeking employment or benefaction, he returned to Florence in the spring of 1348 at the horrendous climax of the Black Death. Now, in place of Greek gods and goddesses, nymphs and shepherds, knights and ladies of his earlier works, Boccaccio created his own version of the human comedy. His tales of daily life would survey the succulent sensualism of medieval life. Seeing the ravages of the Black Death, Petrarch envied happy posterity who will not experience such abysmal woe and will look on our testimony as fable. A Carthusian monk, after attending the burial of his prior and all 34 others in his monastery, with only his dog for a companion, went searching for a refuge. No bells tolled. Nobody wept, no matter what his loss, a Sienese chronicler reported, because almost everyone expected death. People said and believed this is the end of the world. We now know that the cause of the Black Death was a plague bacillus that thrives in the stomach of a particular flea that lives in the fur of the black rat. The bubonic form infects the bloodstream, causing bubules, or swellings of the lymph glands and internal hemorrhages, while the more lethal and more communicable pneumonic form enters the respiratory system. In the 14th century, when neither cause nor remedy was known, the plague was a melodramatic reminder of how a whimsical fortune ruled mankind. All the more so because Europe had been relatively free of the most lethal epidemic diseases since about the 8th century. The Jews, of course, were among the first to be blamed. And across Germany, the flagellants led thousands of Jews to slaughter. The plague had arrived in Europe in October 1347 at the Sicilian port of Messina on Genoese ships coming from the Black Sea. Within 3 years, it would cut down a third of the population of Europe. In the winter of 1348, when the plague reached Florence, the flower of the late medieval Europe, the city was already reeling from civil disorders. Two of the most important banks, including Boccaccio's father's firm, had failed. Boccaccio was understandably exaggerating when he said that more than 100,000 human beings lost their lives within the walls of Florence, what with the ravages attendant on the plague and the barbarity of the survivors toward the sick. We now know that at least half of Florence's 100,000 population died in that plague. People would retire apparently well and die of the disease before they woke. Seldom did an afflicted person survive more than 5 days. The usual course was much shorter. A doctor, it was said, might catch the disease at the patient's bedside and die before he could leave the room. The chronicler of Florence, Giovanni Villani, about 1280 to 1348, ended his life in the middle of a sentence, punctuated by the Black Death. Luckily for us, Boccaccio was there and survived to write the Decameron between 1348 and 1352. His eyewitness account of the plague became the introduction to the first day. Here, an important Masonic lesson. To take pity on people in distress is a human quality which every man and woman should possess. Boccaccio begins while asking the reader's sympathy for his own frustrations in love. To all who have been kind to him, he offers this book, and where it seems to be most needed, to women. And he quotes, "And who will deny that such encouragement, however small, should much rather be offered to the charming ladies than to the men? For the ladies, out of sheer shame and fear, conceal the flames of passion within their fragile breasts. And a hidden love is far more potent than one which is worn on the sleeve, as everyone knows who has had experience in such matters. Moreover, they are forced to follow the whims, fancies, and dictates of their fathers, mothers, brothers, and husbands, so that they spend most of their time cooped up within the narrow confines of their rooms, where they sit in apparent idleness, reflecting on various matters which cannot possibly always be pleasant to contemplate." He promises to provide succor or diversion for the ladies, but only for those who are in love, since the others can make do with their needles, their reels, and their spindles. "I shall narrate 100 stories or fables or parables or histories or whatever you choose to call them. These were to be recited in 10 days by 7 ladies and 3 young men who had fled the plague." But we don't have such horrors around us today. No. We can create frivolity and thoughtless generations and then cast a pious finger at them saying, "Ah, what's wrong with them? The riff-raff." So be the bigger man. Go about your business. Produce those random acts of kindness. And if you are charitable of heart, strive for the highest form of charity, those acts in which the recipient doesn't know and doesn't know that it came from you. Really doesn't create another line on your email. No bragging rights. Boys, we'll go out with a little round midnight. This is by Connie Evanson. She's a real, just a lovely voice. I'll look forward to having you join me next week. Thanks for your patience. Last week was a time zone fiasco. The production of this involves resources that stretch over to Europe. What can I say? It's been a pleasure. Those memories.
When my heart is there with you, and oh midnight moonlight too. When some quarrel we have needs mending, and it looks like our love is ending. Darling, I need you. Lately, I find when you're out. Let the angels sing for your returning. Let our love be safe and sound when only now midnight.
Tree.
when the world knew.
Fire to keep you warm, but most of all.